Welcome to Hotter Than Ever, where we uncover the unconscious rules we've been following, we break those rules, and we find a new path to being freer, happier, sexier, and more self-expressed. I'm your host, Erin Keating. Today, I talk to Megan Reardon Jarvis. She is an author and a psychotherapist specializing in trauma, grief, and loss. Her memoir, The End of the Hour, came out last year, and her story is really powerful and inspiring. What I loved about this conversation is how Megan makes complex and challenging psychological ideas really easy to understand. Okay, this is a new one on me. We talk about how emotions are actually electrical currents that run through our bodies. And then when we make them conscious, we turn them into feelings with our thinking. And sometimes we don't label those feelings correctly. And we kind of brand ourselves as those feelings, like, I am depressed, rather than I feel depressed, the little electrical current of feeling depressed. Ugh, it's so profound. We talk about what trauma really is. That's a word that gets thrown around a lot. And what PTSD actually feels like. There are clearly defined symptoms. She has such an incredible story of needing to heal herself after her own mother's death when she experienced the kind of trauma that she regularly treats in her patients, and how humbling and powerful that experience was. I really loved Megan, and her clear, no-nonsense take on mental health was really refreshing. We also had some great laughs. Take a listen. Welcome to Hotter Than Ever, Megan.
It is so wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
It is so great to have you here to talk about some heavy stuff that is also important that we all face in our lives, which is grief and loss. Mm-hmm. And you're a trauma therapist who specializes in helping patients process grief. So maybe we can start with what brought you to that work. Like, why was that work compelling for you, seeing as you could be kind of any kind of therapist starting out, right?
Yeah. I mean, I went to school to be a social worker after I went to therapy the first time in my life, you know, to help get through a breakup. And social work school is very general. You learn a lot of vague things. And then after you get out of your vagary of 2 years of study, then you kind of have to pick more intense, I guess, like doctors do. You have to sort of pick your field of study. Mm-hmm. And I kept sort of like leaning towards things like working with people who are struggling with addiction, or working with people who are in difficult relationships, or working with women who have anxiety. And part of what was interesting is that there's always a conversation about grief and loss underneath every single one of those things. There's always a loss associated with an addiction. There's always a loss at the root of some kind of anxiety. So I was noticing that we were coming to this conversation about grief and loss in every sort of session that I was doing. And I have this background experience of having had a teenager who was really beloved to my family. And in fact, my whole small town that I grew up in died unexpectedly. He drowned one day when my family and many other people were on the beach. And I, because it was in the early 80s, I grew up not really being spoken to or allowed to speak about or encouraged to speak about this death. So it really wasn't until I went to therapy myself for something I felt was unrelated. You know, I was there for a breakup. Did I discover that unresolved, unprocessed grief really lays this heavy tattoo inside your system? So when I came to understand that, I got curious about it. And really, when I became a therapist, I was always wondering, like, what tattoos do you have in your system?
Oh, God, or even like scar tissue, right? Like,
yeah, yes.
Where it's just there and it's all knotted up and you haven't worked through it or smoothed it out. Oh, yeah. We all have those losses and we just sort of
absolutely,
like pack them inside of ourselves and move on.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's difficult as somebody who specializes in grief and loss, when I'm sitting with someone who it's like, oh my God, part of what's going on for you is that you have new grief packed up on old grief, is I always like almost want to apologize. You know, it's like, I'm so sorry. Nobody taught you any ways to move through this energy. Just sort of collectively in our Western culture, we're really phobic of the idea of talking openly and addressing openly just the natural feelings, thoughts, experiences that any griever can tell you they have.
And there isn't anyone on the planet who hasn't lost someone.
No. I mean, if somebody is listening and they haven't, that's fine. Just know that like your lap is coming. You'll hold the baton at some point because we all do. It's a totally human experience, but often gets lumped into mental health, but it's not, it can impact your mental health, of course. But grief is more like a developmental process. It's like a thing that we will all go through at some point in our life. And in other fields, we just call those developmental stages.
Right. But maybe because it doesn't happen in a linear way and it can happen at any time, then we don't know where
exactly.
to put it.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I will say that in 1982, when the teenager in my life died, the sort of idea of how we help people with grief and loss then really was like, don't talk to kids about that. You know, just try to point them in a different direction and move forward. We know a lot more now about how feelings need to be processed and that children with their intellect being really limited, you right. can't leave them alone with their own feelings because they don't know how to resource themselves. You know, kids believe in Santa Claus. So if they have a complicated, hard feeling of right. fear, let's say, mm-hmm. what they will end up doing is sort of defining themselves by their feeling. You know, a kid goes from feeling afraid to being a kid who is afraid. I am afraid. And
as opposed to a temporary state of having a feeling of fear and that passes through you and you move through and you handle the fear in whatever way, then you become a fearful person.
Yeah. I mean, so many adults that I work with in my practice come in to tell me who they are. And really what they're telling me is they just experience a lot of a feeling, but they're defining themselves by that. So it's, you know, if we don't help folks understand that grief is an energy that is created in our body in response to a loss, and it's totally natural and it's completely normal. And for some people, it's going to always have a magnitude of an 8. And for other people, it might come in as a 3. But that everybody has to figure out a way to kind of move that energy through you. Because if you don't, it takes up residence inside the house and it tries to run the show.
I want to make a poltergeist joke, but I don't.
Do it. I mean,
yeah. I mean, it's a haunting. You know, it's always sort of living with the resonance of that person and that person sort of being there and not being there.
Yeah, the thing about emotions. So emotions are just these little electrical currents that run through our body, and we have thousands of them every day, and they're unconscious. When we turn them into feelings,
Megan, hold on.
What?
Feelings are an electrical current. I've never ever heard it described that way.
So
sorry.
Emotions.
As distinct from
emotions.
Feelings.
Yeah. So emotions are subconscious electrical currents that are running through your body all day long. This work, if people are interested in this, Linda Feldman Barrett and Mark Brackett of the Center for Emotional Studies at Yale, they write about this. And so for some people, they literally have more fear emotions that run up their system and they're unconscious. So we just experience them in our 5 senses. And then we make them conscious with our thinking. And so we start to assign, oh, I am afraid, or I am feeling angry. But you will not be surprised to discover that people don't always label the electrical current of emotion with the proper feeling word. And so because we kind of define our worlds by the way in which we label it, there are a lot of people out there that are experiencing things that I would say cluster in with grief, but don't even know it. Mm-hmm. Don't even realize that some of the reason that they feel dysregulated or feel upset. Like the example I always use is think of the day that you drove home in traffic and you were singing along to Stevie Wonder. And then think of the day that you were driving home in the same kind of traffic and you were swearing and screaming.
Yeah.
What's different in that moment is your emotional state. ask people how they got there, and they don't always know, because so much of it is this sort of subconscious building. And because we don't talk a lot about grief and loss, many, many people miss the idea that, you know, the job here is to take this energy that's been collecting and sort of move it through you. We're really familiar with what it feels like to be tired. We're really familiar with hunger. And so when those things happen, we may not be great at putting ourselves to bed or making sure that we get fed appropriately, but we're aware of what that energy means.
Right.
So when I'm working with people, a lot of what I'm doing is getting them to really touch into what their grief cues are. Like for me, mine is really, I get super irritable with humans. I'll come home and be like, I hate every person on the whole planet today. That person was dumb. And then that person was dumber. And I now kind of understand through my own work, like if I hate the entire human race, there is probably, that is a nice little like waving inside my system of I'm carrying some grief somewhere.
Yeah. And you think of those people who are just generally misanthropic and generally hate the human race. And like, what is going on inside of them all the time? What have they made those electrical currents mean about who they are and how they see the world?
Exactly. And the thing is, even though I sort of I jokingly said that it all comes back to grief, it isn't really a joke. Like we are constantly having the experience of losing something, whether it's I lost my hope or my expectation or my physical health isn't as good as it once was, or I'm not going to, you know, write a Pulitzer Prize winning article, whatever it is that we are having to let go of. When you let go of anything, there's an energy. And so what a lot of people are doing is they are experiencing a loss without actually the letting go of the energy, without moving the energy through them. So it's like, I'm feeling the loss. I got divorced, but I am clinging to the divorce instead of having any skill set or understanding as to how to move through the pain of letting go of the relationship.
I got broken up with recently, and as my first relationship outside of my 17-year marriage. It was a year, and it was amazing. And then the breakup kind of came out of the blue. And it wasn't wrong that it happened.
Yeah.
Just, I hated the way that it happened. But I have been in this like reckoning with all the feelings that I'm having. And all the sadness and all the loss and all the like, wait, you were here one day and now you're gone. And I'm just trying to sit with it in such a way that I really feel the feelings. I really experience the loss. I really write a lot about it. And then I get back on the horse. I'm committed to sort of not hiding from the experience of being alive.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah.
So, what you just said is so beautiful. I'm really sorry, because every breakup is just
the worst.
You know, it's the worst. I mean, it's a process. But what you're reminding me is that part of what we have to do is the being with all the hard feelings that are naturally generated by the loss, without necessarily assigning that the loss was a bad thing. I have a lot of people who like, you know, I'm only allowed to be sad about it if I don't agree with it, or I can only, right? That actually, if you were in a relationship and you're not in a relationship now, of course it's something that you're going to grieve. And there's an incredible neuroscientist who's a friend of mine named Mary Frances O'Connor, who wrote a book called The Grieving Brain. And what this book teaches us, what she teaches so importantly, is when there is something that comes out of nowhere, or we didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
It is like being injured.
Yeah.
Your brain actually reacts to it like an injury. So there's two things going on. There's the, oh my God, my system kind of just got hit by a car that it didn't see coming.
Yeah.
And part of that with grief and loss, she has this concept which is called near, close, now. So we orient ourselves like we're boats in the ocean or airplanes in the sky based on who else is around us. And that, you know, if you go to sleep every night next to someone, they are near, they are close now. Mm. And when someone suddenly says, I'm walking, I'm leaving, and they're not going to be near, close now, it's actually deeply confusing, very scary, and physically painful.
That's what I said to him. I was like, my body is confused.
Yeah. Yeah.
My body is confused.
You're right. Right. You are right. Because the brain is largely a predictive tool. And so it's telling you you're safe. And here's how we know you're safe. The surroundings are similar to as they were before. And as a brain and a body, we don't really want to do new stuff because that's energetically more expensive.
Yeah.
But what happens, and this happens when someone, you know, those terrible phone calls that we get where somebody like had a heart attack and died, is that people's brains, you know, you have this experience of your amygdala, which is the part of the brain that activates the sort of the firefighters of fight, flight, and freeze. It activates those. But when it does that, it sort of shuts off all the rest of the male slots to your brain that also need to function. So your memory, your ability to eat, your ability to sleep, all of that is suddenly not getting the mail that it used to get.
Yeah.
And so not only are you devastated by the loss that you didn't see coming, now it's trying to predict whether or not you're going to be okay in the future, which it can't really do because you haven't lived into this future yet. So it doesn't have a way of saying it's going to be fine. And your body's kind of all screwed up.
Yeah.
Your brain will literally, and your body will learn, oh, this is what we're doing now.
Yeah.
But there's this period of time, which can be a long time, depending on how, you know, how important the relationship was, how long it goes on. Like it's, you know, there are women that I know, they lost a child, they feel it every day and they expect to feel it every day.
Yeah.
But we have this renaissance of feelings. Like if I have a loss now, and it's going to bring up some feelings of loss from before because the brain has like these color-coded tabs where it puts like experiences together. Mm. And so, you know, if my grandfather died, I'm also going to put that in a category in my brain next to like my dog that died and then maybe my favorite singer that died. And so even though they're not equatable, the brain kind of collects them together in these little branches. And so it's really common to even feel more confused because you're like, why am I thinking about my ex-ex when really what's right? Like, why do I feel like that? And then what do we do? What do we do with our hard feelings? You know, that's people say to me like, oh, I know it isn't good that I watched 12 episodes of whatever on Netflix. And I'm like, who told you it wasn't good? Like, if you were going to do that for the rest of your life, we should have a conversation.
Right.
But to do that, to get through in the first fresh throes of grief, that's better than meth. Like, great.
Megan, you should make a bumper sticker. Your coping strategy is better than meth.
So everyone who has ever seen me has heard me say that. They'll come in and they'll be like, oh, I ate an entire sheet cake. And I'm like, well, given your food stuff, that's not great. But again, you know, thresholds here, it's better than meth. Like, right? I mean...
That's so funny.
It's just real. It's just
real. Universal. It's so universal. Everybody's been dumped. Everybody's lost people. Everybody goes through all of this stuff. And, you know, what I'll say as like a person in midlife who's come through the other side of a long, unhappy marriage is I'm just grateful to feel things. I'm just grateful to care and to be able to be
totally
present with myself and not be stuffing it down with food or overwork and just sort of being willing to be uncomfortable. I'm so much more willing to be uncomfortable at this stage of my life. And it's something I'm trying to teach my kids, you know, oh, we had this conversation in class and everybody was, it was so uncomfortable. And I just say like, like life is uncomfortable. Real things are uncomfortable. Yeah. This notion that everybody is supposed to feel comfortable all the time is really yeah. does a disservice to us as human beings.
We act like it's a failure. And what I often say to people, and I feel like it sort of lands, is like, listen, early sex is really awkward too. You know, they make it seem like it's amazing in the movies, but it's usually pretty like weird and awkward and you feel self-conscious and all that stuff. But no one has ever once suggested that because it felt weird and awkward, you should not do it again or not try it again. What we say about sex is like, oh, it just gets better. Don't worry. You just move through that period of awkwardness and then you kind of can figure yourself and your partner out, or at least that's the game plan. Like if it doesn't get less awkward, then maybe that's more of a relationship issue. But you are correct that we have this, like, I think we equate the awkwardness with some kind of like failing or like not cool or not being suave or not being a, you know, an achiever. And I, you know, I have conversations with my kids about what are our expectations about how do we learn anything? Like, how do we get to learn anything if, because I grew up quite afraid of sort of rocking the boat. And so I didn't take big risks. And I'm turning 50 and I'm telling you, I fail every day. Every day I get an email that's like, nope, didn't work out. And I'll say to somebody, yeah, no, that writing residency rejected me, or, you know, I'm not going to do an interview with that person. Because I want to use my language to normalize that if you want to have the life that you want, you have to do things like be in relationships, even though no one can promise you they'll be permanent. Try something that you're not sure you're going to be amazing at.
Yeah.
It's so hard, but it's so important. And I really, what I was thinking when you were saying about like, you're just grateful to be a person who feels now, one of the things that happened, I write about this in my book, End of the Hour, when my mom died, I immediately started to have PTSD symptoms and everything that I'm describing that's going on for you right now, where you feel confused and you're in sort of fight flight mode. And it just is pretty hard. I had that. And I had it with the metacognition of being a teacher who teaches people about it, right? So I was like, oh, I know what's going on in my system. But knowing what was going on in my system did not keep my digestive tract from completely shutting down. So I went probably 20 days without eating more than like a handful of peanuts. And what is surprising, or not surprising maybe to some people, is like you can manage to not eat food and still not drop weight because your cortisol levels are high.
Your body's like holding on to it. Yeah.
Yes. No one was like rushing at me the way I have seen happen to some people, like, oh my God, you are really unwell. Like I was taking a shower, I was buttoning the buttons on my sweater. So people thought I was kind of okay.
Right.
And it's been 4.5 years since my mom died. And I am only now starting to feel safer around food again, around trusting that that my body is going to, one, send me hunger cues because they just shut off for so long. And so in order to have nutrients, I would just have to like eat on a schedule, which is not a great way to live, you know, to just like, okay, well, I need to eat some crackers now because it's been 3 hours since I ate last time.
Right.
But I think there are so many ways that our system, in order to survive hard things, can shut down, can mute, can turn the volume all the way down.
I really relate to that because that's the story of my marriage. You know, I just shut off so many parts of myself and so many natural reactions in order to just be in it and survive it.
Yeah.
And it's not like I was being beaten, you know, it's just that it's just the particular dynamics sucked in the particular ways that they did. And I wanted to stay married and I didn't want to be a single mom. And so there were compromises that I made that I shut down so many systems inside myself and operated on the most survival level so that I wouldn't feel all the pain that I was actually feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, I think that's a really brave thing to say. Secondly, I bet people can really deeply relate to that. And third, I think it is important to let people know that like, when you wake that up, So what's happening for me sort of in the past, I'm going to say 4 or 5 months, is I notice the compulsion to emotionally eat. So I've been on this like, oh, I don't really have any hunger. Okay, now I'm going to try to set myself a regimen so that I can eat some food. And now I'm like, oh, wait a second. This is how food used to screw me over.
Right.
This is how I used to be super dysfunctional with food. Now that I'm having a renaissance of that hard thing.
Right.
And right. I'll take
food
this
as a
over the
solution to emotional problems. Right.
Yeah. Just as a tool. Right. I mean, we all manage our difficult emotions in all kinds of ways. And again, when I'm working with clients and they tell me I'm doing it in this dysfunctional way, what I say is we're not here to be perfect. We're here to maybe not do harm.
Right.
And so what are the things? But I'm having this renaissance with food, which is suddenly a reminder of, oh, I used to do this with my tough feelings as a kid. Oh, I used to do this. Mm-hmm. And I would rather this, like I would rather have a mind-body connection reinstilled. But it reminds you that, you know, we live inside bodies that hold histories.
Yeah.
And those histories have helped inform how we live. And it's complicated. As a woman who's almost 50, it is so complicated.
It is so complicated, Megan. Yeah. And I think for a long time, I wanted to just be a head. Like I didn't want to have a body. I didn't want to be in a body. I didn't want to be responsible for a body.
Yeah.
And the older I get, and also the more of these kinds of conversations that I have, and also I'm going to this like woo-woo chiropractor and I'm doing Pilates and I'm doing all this stuff that is like really integrating
in
mind
your body.
And body and I'm having sex and like all those things that I wasn't doing for a really long time. I am now seeing like where things are trapped in my physical self.
Yeah.
Where my emotion is held in my hips. And when I release my
God,
hips.
That's such a thing.
There's tears, you know, there's tears. We've been working. And this is so personal. I'm going to share it just in case it's helpful to other people. I've had a painful C-section scar for 13 years since my twins were born. Yeah. We have been working on breaking up the scar tissue from my C-section scar with this woo-woo chiropractor. And I am feeling like all kinds of things let go and dissipate. Like, the body is a receptacle for all of this emotion, and we want to pretend like we are, it's a totally separate thing from our brains, and it fucking is not.
Well, listen, I come from the field of academia where I felt real nice and comfortable with my master's degrees. So I cannot tell you how much, and really, I think not patronizingly, but I'm really comfortable. If a client comes in and says to me, I'm getting a lot out of X, and I haven't studied that and maybe don't think it's real science. And, you know, I'm happy for you to do that, but I don't know how to support that in here because it's not what I'm trained in. Okay. Then my mom, well, first my dad dies, then my mom dies. And suddenly,
maybe this is a good chance, Megan, to sort of tell the story of how you came to write your memoir, The End of the Hour, and your own experience with grief and how it sort of pushed up against your expertise.
Oh, it's so good. So I've been a trauma-informed therapist, so the body-centered kind. All the people come in and they want to tell me how they think about it. And I'm like, and where in your body can you feel that energy? And what color is it? And how big is it? And does it move? So I've been practicing that sort of therapy for a really long time. And I deeply, deeply believe in it. And I come from the world of, you know, master's degrees and lots of study and lots of training. So in 2016, my dad was diagnosed with small cell cancer, and small cell cancer is a terminal cancer upon diagnosis. So he was diagnosed with small cell cancer and he died exactly a year and a week to his diagnosis. A full year of sort of knowing that he was getting less and less well and that he was going to die. He understood he was going to die. I understood he was going to die. And even though we didn't have the easiest relationship, I'm not sure how much he liked me. And I didn't find him the easiest to like, but I loved him deeply. And so when he was dying, mostly what I did was just sit with him. I just flew to where he was and was like, I just think you deserve to feel love. So I'm just going to sit with you. So that to me was like within the window of tolerance. Like my body sort of, it's the opposite of being broken up with suddenly. It's like small sips of grief every weekend, you know? So I drink a gallon, but in small sips. In 2019, my mom died suddenly while I was on vacation with her. And she'd had a short illness. She'd had sort of like a stomach ache. And I was there in her house with her kids and my dog. And I was driving to Boston from Cape Cod, where she was. And I had my three kids in the car who were little. And I had this sensation of water breaking in my pelvis. It was so real that I looked down like, what just happened? And I wasn't pregnant. Whoa. I just had this sensation. And then sort of from the back of the right side of my head, I saw in black letters, she died. And I knew it was true. I just like knew it was true. So I had just pulled to pick up my godson. My kids ran into the house and I called my husband, who was back at my mother's house working. And I was like, have you seen my mom? I think she died. And he was like, what are you talking about? I think she went to church. And I was like, she didn't go to church. I'm pretty sure she died. And so now he's texting me like, the door to her bedroom is closed. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. I need you to go in. And the kids are back in the car and I'm driving now through Boston, which like you can't even take a left-hand turn anywhere in Boston. It's just a nightmare of a city. So then I call him and my daughter is like clocking this because I am a do not text, do not be on the phone mom.
Normally
if I had to do something, I would turn to her and be like, don't yell at me. I have to. But she's clocking what's happening. And she says, is everything okay? And I say, I think we're about to get terrible news. And my husband picks up. First, I call him and it goes to voicemail. And I'm like, oh, he's on the phone with the emergency services. Then he calls me back and says, I need you to pull over. So again, I'm in Boston. So I end up on this cloverleaf pullover where for like 8 minutes, I'm driving in a circle and I end up in a parking lot at a like a broken down. It was a Dairy Princess. It wasn't even a Dairy Queen. And I'm there. And my husband says she died. Actually, he didn't. He said, I'm so sorry. And then I said, she died. Like she really died. And almost instantly, like a truck driving out of traffic, I again saw these words, it's your fault. So immediately, and you have to understand that like I treat people for PTSD. I treat people who have been suffering in silence for years with not sleeping, not eating, all the physical symptoms and a lot of the mental health symptoms of unresolved grief. So I hear this, which we call a rumination, like it's your fault she died. And I'm like, oh, that's not good. Like, I know what that is. That could come to get me. And it did. I mean, by the end of the day, I was like, oh, okay, I'm not going to be able to get out from underneath this belief. This phrase over here that's like almost like a magician that's going like, look over here. It's going, look over here. It's your fault. Beat yourself up. Be upset about that. Hate yourself for not doing more. Because if you don't look over here, you're going to be standing in the reality of your life, which is you have to now live it without your parents. You have to figure out how to be on the planet without really like the tugboat that's always just been right behind you or right in front of you.
Right.
That was always there to orient you if you got overwhelmed or if you, and, you know, my mom and I were close. We were not the closest members of our family. We were close, but it was so disorienting because I was always the kid who was like looking like, hey mom, am I doing a good job? Or hey mom, are you okay? There just wasn't a minute that I wasn't looking over my shoulder and being like, what do you think? How you doing? Are you okay? Which in clinical terms, we call codependent. Like if you can't just be in your lane without checking on other people, that's a codependent kind of relationship. And so when she died, I just had no idea who I was. I had no idea how to be on the earth and a person. And it really made me deeply isolate, which is another thing that grievers do, not just because everybody else was doing their normal lives and I was in this dizzying state of loss, but also because I couldn't bear it when people who knew me as a functioning, you know, normal, I'm happy all the time. So the idea that I wasn't happy, I was like, I couldn't bear when people would look at me and they would kind of, I looked, you know, I've showered, I had a sweater on. I looked normal.
Right.
But I wasn't myself. No. I wasn't.
Right. Right. Oh God. Yeah. And then how to have all of this scholarly knowledge about what is going on with you and diagnosing yourself as you go through this experience. I think we throw around the terms PTSD and trauma in the culture, like in the way that we throw around narcissism or bipolar or OCD. Or
depressed.
Depressed. Yeah. Like, can you break down what PTSD actually is and what trauma actually is and how to know it when you see it?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And again, it feels like one of those things where it's like people should just know it like they know that DC is the capital of the country. Like, trauma is a bad event. That's it. It's just a bad event. So for many, many people, COVID was, well, so COVID is a collective trauma that we all go through. Mm-hmm. But for many people, it did not leave them traumatized. So a trauma is the bad thing that happens. Traumatized is the meaning that your system makes of it. Mm. So you and I could both be in a car accident and you get out and say, wow, that was crazy. I'm going to go tell my, you know, colleagues at work about it. You're not traumatized. I get out of the car and I'm like, I'm never getting in a car again. I am traumatized. My life, the meaning that I have made in my life is less than. I now can't travel in cars. Mm-hmm. So trauma can be anything. People will often say to me, I don't know if this counts. I don't know if this is a trauma. And here's the thing. It's not for me to tell you you had a trauma. You get to own the impact of something on you. So I've had clients whose like parents left them in a car and went into the supermarket for 25 minutes. And that was traumatizing to them.
Yeah.
We might not look at that as a typical trauma, but to a kid who got really activated and terrified and thought my parents are never coming back, that gets to be diagnosed as a trauma. So PTSD, in the moment when you are going through a trauma, your body does a whole series of physiological things to protect you. And it, like I said, it activates the amygdalas, which are these two tiny, like almond shaped parts of the brain that then turn on the fight, flight, and freeze responses. When you can fight against something or run away from something, you are less likely to experience it as a trauma because you're already moving that terror energy through your body, right? Just in the resistance. When we go into freeze, which is the activated part of our brain does the fight and flight, the parasympathetic, which is the soothing part of our brain, does freeze. And freeze can look like a high freeze, like deer in headlights, where you just like stop moving, or it can be like you curl into a ball, into a collapse. But we are much more susceptible in those moments to the energy landing in our body and staying there. That is where we believe in freeze and in collapse. That's where we believe that the energy goes from just being a bad thing that happened, a trauma, to your system is not able to get the energy out. So it tattoos in and then you become traumatized, right? And so when we talk about PTSD, PTSD in really short form is just there is no trauma in front of you, but something, some small nuanced, a sound, a smell, something in your five senses activates and brings you like time travel back to that moment where you were in that state of high alert threat. So PTSD is you are reliving inside your body with the five senses experience and all the adrenaline and all the amygdala stuff, something that you've already survived. And so we consider it maladaptive because it's adaptive in the moment. You need all that to survive the moment. It's maladaptive when it's just repeating on you. So that's how I think about it, is it's a bit of time travel where your body is having a reaction that is outsized because you're not in a traumatic situation anymore.
What triggers that? Because I feel like there's stuff that happened in my childhood that I had a consistent freeze reaction to again and again and again. And I learned to kind of close off the feeling pieces so that I could just get through it. And food became a huge solution for me.
Yeah.
Because I needed that soothing. But where is that showing up again in my life? Like, how do I know if it's just a trauma or that I'm traumatized or that I have PTSD?
Yeah. So I always refer people to this, that there are a bunch of things that you can do that are self-evaluative online. So you can go and do the PTSD checklist.
Oh, I love that.
And it, yeah. And it's really helpful actually, because it sort of says like, does this happen to you X amount of times often?
Yeah.
And I think it helps you get a sense of like, how often is this happening? For me, I just knew that my stuff was PTSD because it was anytime I closed my eyes, you know, and my symptoms were getting worse and not better. But your question is a brilliant one. So I want to address it, which is when I have survived something in the past with a series of tools, whatever they were, and they're going to be really, when it happens in our childhood, they're going to be very simplistic tools because kids don't have the capacity to, like, I don't know, do a pickup basketball game with friends. You know, you end up eating, sleeping, isolating, usually some sort of arts or something physical with your body. And those, again, they can be adaptive or maladaptive. But what we kind of know about our ability to manage things is that it works. We will continue to use that tool for as long as it works and as long as the threat is there. What happens when we think about PTSD with a veteran? The veteran is having all that activation on the battlefield.
Yeah.
But the veteran cannot go into freeze. Because that would not be, they're going to die.
Bias towards action. They need a bias towards action.
Right. Yeah. And so they stay in the fight and flight, even though they have that helpless, hopeless moment of freeze, but they can't stay there. So for many folks who survive, maybe the ones who didn't survive did go into freeze, but the ones who come home with that energy trapped in their system. And here's the thing that is mind-boggling, is that as they become safer, as the threat level drops, as their system begins to sit, to understand, like think about near, close, now, people will protect me. There's no weaponry around me. I'm safe. I'm not sleeping in a field. As their system begins to experience this is safety, out come all those feelings, all the ones that were put in there because of the terrified experience, but we couldn't feel them, because if we felt them, they would have gotten us killed.
Right.
So it is really common. And it's one of the reasons why there's a very high rate of suicidality amongst veterans, is that they come home and about 12 months to 2 years in, they are overwhelmed with all these horrifying thoughts and feelings. When they come back, it takes a while for the ways in which the body has built up protectors. So the hormones and the neurotransmitters that generate things like your cortisol and adrenaline, they begin to understand we don't need to overfunction. This person is not in threat. And as all of that drops away, suddenly what's there are all the feelings that were not felt. And so these veterans, even though it's 2 years later, are suddenly having nightmares, feeling hopeless, feeling terrified, and smelling things that aren't there, you know, feeling at threat when someone raises their voice, things that are really, really difficult to manage.
Yeah. Whew, it's all so heavy duty.
I know. I know. I mean, the good thing, I think, is that when you understand that we live our lives inside our bodies and our bodies are a giant filter to our experiences, what my book talks about is how I really do have to be a recipient. I end up checking myself into the same mental health facility that I send all of my clients. Oh. I'm there for 21 days and I'm doing all of the same treatment modalities that are really designed to regulate your central nervous system, which is your spine and your brain, so that I can do the hard job of learning to live in the world without my mom.
Yeah.
But for a while there, what my body wants to do is just be totally freaked out and disruptive. And what happens to me, and I write about it in the book, is the first thing that happens is I'm trying to do the things. So I'm swimming, I'm doing all the stuff, you know, I'm swimming, I'm trying to eat well, I'm trying to sleep.
Right. You're giving yourself treatment plans.
Yeah. I'm doing all the things that I would advise a client. Right. And this insane thing happens where I every time I say this out loud, I'm like, okay, people are going to turn off the radio show now. Small bones grew across the canals of my ears.
What?
It's called extatosis. No, it's real. This is really what happened. So I'm swimming as a way to exercise. Yeah. And these little bones grew like stalactites and stalagmites, and they grew towards each other. And they trapped the water in my ear. So I go to an ENT and he's like, you're going to have these, you know, surgically removed. And then he says to me, you know, and probably it's going to impact your hearing. So is like listening, is that a part of your life or your job or anything?
No. No big deal. Yeah.
Wait a minute. What are you talking about? What the fuck exactly? I mean, that was a really, in the book, like that is a really dark moment for me when the guy says to me, like, this has been caused essentially by the swimming. Now, normally those growths happen to like 18-year-old surfers and they take a long time to develop. But again, when your body's doing all these crazy things because the hormones are out of whack, you know, I know people who in their trauma, their feet grew. So all kinds of stuff can happen to your bones and to your muscles. Secondarily, so I get that piece of news and I'm completely devastated. And so then I decide I'm going to pivot to yoga because I know I need to move the energy out of my body. And I come downstairs into my basement and I throw my back out so badly, just like bending over to put the yoga mat down. I throw my back out so badly that I had bruises on my shins from falling on the ground for 5 months. That's how hard I went down on the ground. For 5 months, I had bruises like underneath my knees and I couldn't get up for 3 days. And I was in so much pain. I was just screaming. And again, when I look back at that, I have a lot of compassion for myself because it was so painful. But also I have like just this wonder at my body because I was not going to stop moving.
Right.
I was not going to slow down.
Right.
I was going to go right back to work. I was not going to take the time.
Right.
And I think my body was like, well, we're going to make you. Yeah. And that it was from that position of, you know, not being able to get up and use the bathroom. It was from that position that I called a colleague and was like, I can't do it. Yeah. I need help.
And it takes so much humility. I mean, your body was like, I am not allowing you.
I was desperate.
You were desperate, but at the same time, check yourself into the place where you check your patients in. It's a status shift. It's an admission of vulnerability and of being a human. And, you know, that all your expertise couldn't solve this, that you need help.
I think about it. I say this having, you know, given birth to 3 kids and lots of other things, but it's the thing I'm the most proud of in my life is that I did that. And in the course of it, and I write about it in the book, I feel like there was a lot of like maybe divine grace in getting me there because the person who spoke to me on the phone, I was just going to let him know I wasn't coming. And somehow whatever he said to me was exactly all the right words. And then my daughter's best friend rang the doorbell. My daughter was upstairs and said, do you want to come out and play? And I heard my daughter say, I think I should probably stay here in case my mom needs me. And I was like,
that familiar to you from your own childhood?
Yeah, I was like, I'm not creating a little codependent creature who thinks she can't live her life. So I think without the person who called me and spoke to me the way he did, and that moment of overhearing my daughter and realizing what she was accidentally signing up for, I don't know that I would have had the courage, if that's the right word, because I really did sort of feel like if I don't do something, I might die.
Yeah.
I wasn't suicidal. I just felt like I can't see a way out of here that doesn't get bleaker and worse.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, the minute the gentleman's name, he's a good friend of mine now, Chase, the minute I said to Chase, like, okay, I'll come, I hung up, fell asleep for 3 hours. I hadn't been sleeping. And then stood up and walked upstairs.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's so much power in surrender. I mean, I'm,
yes,
you know, I was in a 12-step program for food for 7 years, and
yeah,
so much of just walking through that door and being like, yeah, I don't know, I can't do it anymore. I can't do this battle alone anymore. Like, that surrender is so powerful in changing our lives. And sort of going, yeah, I can't,
it's such,
fix everything.
It, I mean, I say this with so much like humility, but all of my favorite people are in recovery.
Yeah.
Because you end up having to live with so much integrity when you're not numbing. Right. Yeah. So like, numbing is the way that you used to get through. And you and I just said it, when you take the numbing away, it often feels a lot worse for a while.
Yeah.
And the courage and the sort of like belief and hope that you can do all that feeling without the numbing is so petrifying and then wildly empowering. The people I trust the most are all my sober friends, because I'm like, well, you get up every day and do something harder than a lot of people do, you know, in whatever they're doing. Your first minutes of the day are harder than some people's entire week.
Mm. Yeah, I love the recovery and the language of recovery and the culture of recovery. Yeah. Has been so deeply, deeply impactful for me and gave me a spiritual life, which I didn't have before. And I still use things, you know, I use all kinds of things to get through, but.
Right. But so that's the point. That's not the point. The point is that we don't use things. It's that we don't use them to our destruction.
Yeah. I try not to.
Right?
Theater on the edge.
Is it meth?
Is
it meth? If it's not meth, then we're okay.
It's not meth. It's not meth. Oh my God, Megan, you're amazing. When are we hanging out?
I know.
I love this conversation. I feel like we could talk for another hour, but I want to ask you the question that I ask everyone who comes on this podcast, which is, you've been through so much. You've developed a new depth of your expertise, right? Through your own experience.
Right.
God, when we can bring empathy to the table, when we can bring like, yeah, honey, I've been there to the table, it changes so much. Are there any deal terms in your own life today where you are to just at this moment that you want to renegotiate with yourself, with the people in your life, with the world?
Oh, God, that's a good question. And I have heard you ask that before, so you would think I'd be prepared for it.
People say this.
Jeez, Megan, that was not wise. You didn't see that one coming. No, so, well, let me say a couple of things about that. My marriage did shift really significantly when I came out of treatment, because I basically handed my husband like the keys to the kingdom when I left. And so I have been through this reckoning, and the reckoning is more about honesty. Like, I was doing a lot of stuff. I was raised by a mom who was a full-time mom.
Yeah.
And not only defined that as her job, but it was very much the job of a woman. So I was doing a lot of stuff without wanting to do it.
Yeah.
Without asking him to think about, I just was doing it. In the book, we have this fight about paper towels on the way. He's driving me to the airport so I can go to treatment facility. And he says to me, like, listen, I have a master's degree. Like, I can figure out how to buy paper towels. And I get really mad, because I'm like, you have never once had to think about paper products and how they get into this house. So don't act like it's unreasonable for me to be saying to you, don't forget to buy paper towels. So when I came back out, what I noticed was, maybe part of this is also being 50, because I speak to women who are 50 and I'm like, oh, you didn't have to check yourself into an inpatient facility to get there. But I don't have the like bullshit anymore. I don't have the capacity to betray myself by saying yes to stuff. Ugh. So I just can't do it. It's like the difference between maybe being wealthy and you're like, sure, whatever, I'll pick up your dinner. Let me buy your dinner, because I have plenty of money. But then you don't have the money. Like, I don't have the, and I don't have it.
Yep.
So when people want to be my friend, I have to want to be their friend back. I used to be like, sure, come over, we'll do whatever. Now I'm like, I don't know. I need to rank you on a scale of likability and decide.
Yeah.
Right. So I would say I am in it, and I'm doing a thing tonight with Christy Tate. She wrote a beautiful book called BFF, which is about female friendships. So I am in a space where my relationships with women are shifting, And I really have to own my own part, which is I think I have let people in and close to me that maybe I did not intentionally choose. So that part of like, who do I want to be my friends? And what and how am I defining friendship? And what is it that I get out of friendship? Like yeah. what I'm really looking at that right now. So that is, that's a hard road because it's not like, oh, I just need to have better friends. It's like, Megan, who are you? What are you doing? What are you contributing?
Yeah. And how are you showing up in your life such that the right friendships can come
forward? Yeah. And yeah. what kind of a friend are you? You know, if somebody comes to you and this happens, because I, you know, a lot of my friends are people who've done a lot of therapy. They'll come to me and be like, I am disappointed in how you are showing up in my life. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I am going to listen to that. I'm not necessarily going to sign up for what you would like me to do, but I need to think about it. I went to an event recently and a woman was like, oh, I want you to meet my friend. And I went over and she had just moved to this country. And I was like, oh, how do you like it here? And she was like, you know, I'm finding it really hard and it's very difficult. And I was like, oh, you're my people.
Yeah.
Because what I am used to or yeah, what people would be, oh, I love it. DC is so lovely. This woman was like, it's really hard and I cry at night. And I was like, oh, let's go sit down and have a conversation. I'm ready to like, I would like to know more about you.
Yeah.
So I am really reckoning in my relationships. And I haven't said this out loud, but I have actually also just totally stopped drinking.
Uh-huh.
In a way that I'm calling quiet quitting.
Yeah.
I know quiet quitting means something else, but I'm not defining it as a drinking problem. I've never had a drinking problem. I just cannot metabolize alcohol in a way that is good for my body. The same way that like, I don't eat Starbursts because that's like putting plastic inside my body. So I like the way it tastes, but I will pay for that for days. Alcohol is, we just need to be done with each other. We need to be solidly done with each other.
I'm hearing that a lot from women in midlife that alcohol just kind of quits on them.
It will keep me up all night. It's like some people don't eat gluten and there's a lot of history with drinking that is so fraught. And for me, I just sort of feel like this is just stupidly simple. I just need to not do it.
Yeah.
Right? Just don't do it.
I love it. I love it so much about this conversation and the conversations I've been having in this past year on the podcast have really been about like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You do not have to accept the status quo, especially if it feels like shit.
Like, no,
you know,
let's
you have
do nothing
choices.
That feels like shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amen, sister. Amen. Megan, thank you for coming on. I have loved this conversation.
This has been really important to me. I had lots of chills while we were talking, and I just want to say this to you. So when people are doing hard things like navigating after a breakup, I do this thing where like I put their name on a piece of paper and then I burn it in a candle and I send it like this little bit of light that's supposed to wink at you. So because I think we catch each other, all that pain is the thing that actually connects us, even though we don't always choose to connect to it. So I'm just going to be thinking about you while you're doing this hard thing, which is becoming a new part of yourself without this relationship. And I'm going to light this little candle and I'm going to send it to you. And at some point in the next couple of days, you're going to see something twinkle. I know I sound so ridiculous.
Oh my God.
But I mean it. Something will like sparkle and you'll be like, that's because Megan is thinking about me right now. And she lit that candle and she knows the heartbreak of, you know, having to let go of something when you didn't choose it and you don't know how.
Yeah. Thank you. I accept your woo.
Yeah.
I will take the woo.
Good.
I appreciate it. I feel the love. I'm so grateful to know you.
Right back at you. Thank you so much for doing this with me.
Thanks for listening to Hotter Than Ever. Have you been listening to our weekly specious advice episodes? We are always looking for more great questions. So if you have any issues in your life you would like my very biased and totally unqualified feedback on, DM us on Instagram at hotterthaneverpod, or call and leave a voicemail or text your questions to the Hotter Than Ever Hottie hotline at 323-844-2303. You know what I would love the most? I would love to answer your question in a future episode. Hotter Than Ever is produced by Erica Gerard and Podkit Productions. Our associate producer is Melody Carey. Music is by Chris Keating, with vocals by Issa Fernandez. Come back next week
for advice, profound insights, stupid laughs, and incredible conversations about things that mean something to women our age.